Oh, I'll tell you all about Primal Scream. It's pretty amazing.
We don't have much time, so we don't
want to cover Well, no, I mean, we can...
Full hour.
Okay. But there's a lot of great stuff to get into.
Yeah, we like to talk. We like to hear ourselves talk.
Just keep talking. I'll let you know when we're done.
So what is Primal Scream? Do you want to tell me now?
Oh, yeah. Primal Scream is basically, so before finals, the night before finals started, you would go and you would streak naked around the yard.
Okay.
And it was a thing that, you know, not everybody did. I did it all 8 semesters.
It's because you're an exhibitionist.
Yeah, exactly. But most people would do it one time. I did it 8 times. It was one of the Van Buren boys. And then...
So is it like at a particular time of day?
Like, oh, it's at night. I think it was like midnight or something like that. And then the other thing was that most people are like wearing a scarf and trying to hang back in the pack so nobody sees them. I would always go to the front of the pack. And I would always, like, paint myself up to be more visible.
Yeah.
So I did it various times. One time I did it entirely in... The first time I did it entirely in gold body paint with silver wings. So I looked like the FTD man.
What's FTD?
That's the, like, flower delivery guy. You know, the little Hermes
wings. Oh, right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And then another time I did it all in white. And I took a dining hall plate and, like... posed periodically as the discus thrower.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
and
so
then,
funny.
And another time I painted myself entirely yellow and red, and I had some Papua New Guinean stuff from my my parents, and I went as a Huli Huli tribesman. Wow. So, but, you know, always to draw. And then the time that I was on the front cover, I was painted entirely yellow with a red hammer and sickle on my belly, and it was all part of like a prank war between the houses.
So a hammer and sickle, like the Russian,
so
or USSR,
because we rebranded our house. Are we rolling? Oh,
I was gonna say this is a good time.
Okay, thank you, Andrew Hunt, as always.
Yes.
Okay.
Hello,
ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Mixed Metal Arts. We are here in the dojo, the LA dojo. Very kindly provided by Andrew Hunt.
Yes.
And it is my pleasure to have in the dojo with me Christopher Leon Price, otherwise known as Big Papa Werewolf.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to be here. Big Papa Werewolf, I don't know why it's stuck. I don't know why we continue.
It's amazing.
Because I don't know why people continue to call me it, but I will not object to being called Big Papa Werewolf. It's like one of those names that, like, you have to be a real badass to really own. And I don't know if I'm badass enough to own it yet. But if people want to call me that, then that's fine.
But it's like all of these things. I had this conversation. So the unicorn, Matt Madonna, made a meme of Brian, and it's Brian's head, but like on the most ripped male masculine body. And
so
like,
his own body, then.
His own body.
Basically. Yeah.
But him in a bathtub, like just, and I sent it to Brian, and it said, you know, up at the top he put Callan Fate, and he goes, you know you want it, or something like that.
Who
right?
doesn't want to be that, though, with Brian?
Exactly.
Can I address something about, like...
about the Emperor.
About the Emperor, Brian Hound. Here's the thing, is that, like, if I legitimately didn't like Brian and what he did, then I wouldn't like buy into drinking the Emperor's Kool-Aid as much. But because I legitimately like Brian, like right now, I think that they're filming or shooting a fight companion, and Brian is over with Rogan and Schaub and all of them. And whenever I listen to those, Brian always says things that are like spot fucking on, like he's making an interesting insight that makes him sound like the professional, even though he's surrounded by like legit professionals, and everybody else is just completely naysays him. Everybody's no, Brian, like whatever, and he like kind of like pumps it up a little bit. He likes to say he likes to be a kickboxer and he's wrestling and all that stuff. So he's aware in that way. So they kind of like to keep him when he's down, but he says insightful good shit, and if he didn't, I don't think he would have as many fans as he does.
But see, I think that's the great thing about the Emperor is that firstly, the Emperor's comedy is built around him building himself up and then tearing himself down,
which is hilarious, and it's like kind of deprecating humor that he has found a way in his own social circles, and it's probably where he got most of his training from, really, to how to like ride that line. And if you don't get it, you can be like, what the fuck, this guy thinks he's full of himself, but he really doesn't.
That's not the point.
Yes, exactly.
And also, Cruz crucially, that actually Brian, because of the breadth of his experience, is actually, and that's not to imply that he's old, to be clear, but the breadth of his experience that he's managed to earn at such a young age.
Sure.
But because of that, you know, he actually does have like a lot of good insights.
Mm-hmm.
But is consistently, I think, by that community underrated.
I think that like Brian's in a weird in between.
Yeah.
He has a mind that can kind of, and I can relate to this to a certain extent because my first podcast that I had in Phoenix, Arizona was called the Geek Jock Podcast because I felt that I was like equal parts geeky as I was jock. I was into sports and being athletic and in that quote unquote like American machismo mindset, but I also loved games and electronics and film and all this other geeky kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Brian is kind of in the same way. He likes wine and he likes comedy and he
cheeses
and cheeses and many other things that would put him in one part. You know, some people would want to pigeonhole him.
That's right.
Into something, and then he's also he does enjoy mixed martial arts and martial arts. So like. And he has, like, you know, his Rogan bros, and then he's got his more intellectual buddies. You know what I mean? And it's kind of like, not to say that Rogan and his guys aren't intellectuals. They are to a certain extent in their own right. But it's just interesting when somebody has a dynamic like that.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes people from either side of that dynamic will want to either claim ownership or degrade or mock for being not completely one way or the other.
That is an amazing example of tribalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the point is that tribes, and people don't realize that they're doing this, right? But tribes have a certain set of values, and then you have a member who is not towing those values, and you sense that they're not towing those values, and then you're trying to whip them in line. You're trying to get them to conform to whatever tribe there is. And that is the basic thing for someone like Brian, is that because he does exist in many tribes, right, that constantly they're trying to police him into one tribe or another.
And I think that's something that's universal, right? Like, who hasn't felt like Brian Callen at some point in their life? Whether it's your work relationships or your career and those kinds of people, and then there's like maybe your someone who's in your family and that kind of culture, whatever it is they brought into it. I think that there's constant conflicts and contrasts because we're not one type of person who hangs out with one type of people. We are a plethora of personalities and ideas and concepts.
Every hero has 1,000 faces.
Yes, absolutely. That's what's his face?
It's Joseph Campbell is the hero with 1,000 faces.
Hero's
journey. I think that's part of the culture that we're creating in mixed mental arts, and part of the culture that I would want to see emerge sort of globally, is one that understands that every hero has 1,000 faces and that we're all heroes, and that, you know, gives people the permission to like have all these different sides to their personality, and just as like, hey, that's what's great, right? Like,
and that's kind of, sorry for interrupting, Hunter, but
always interrupting.
Yes, I, because if I don't, just keep going.
You gotta get a word in edgeways.
This is where the cultural confessions are really insightful and interesting, is because we get to see that the way someone looks or where they're from. And how their culture all kind of mixed together to make them who they are. And it kind of shatters a lot of stereotypes, and it lets everybody know that there's, what is it? Everybody has like their own story and their own, novel, or I'm at a loss for words, but basically everybody has their own world and their own universe within themselves. And I think that kind of being able to articulate that is hugely beneficial to people, and being able to listen to that is something that can make us hate each other less, which is what I hope everybody's trying to fucking do.
Well, and crucially, I think that's the interesting thing, right? Is that, you know, I mean, I've talked to Brian about this before, right? Like, you know, Brian, like all of us, is this weird, like, you know, especially when you're a kid, right? You are this mix of broken pottery pieces, right?
In so many ways
and you just got this big bag of broken pottery, and it's like, I got all this shit from my mom, this shit from my dad, I get this shit from my school, I get this shit from, you know, my country, my culture, my church, my temple, my, you know, atheist cult, whatever it is. And then you have all these broken pottery pieces, and so much of what your life is about is making kintsugi. And how do you take your own set of broken pieces and make your own pot? mm-hmm. that fills in the cracks with gold? And how are you figuring out how to use all of these painful experiences from your childhood to make something beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the experience for all of us. But I mean, that's what Brian has done with his comedy, right? That's mm-hmm. what you were doing with the Geek Jock podcast mm-hmm. is like, there are these two things that everyone is trying to tell me can't go together.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out how do they fit together. Mm-hmm. And that is the nature of these undoing projects where you got these two pieces and you keep trying to ram them together and they won't go together. And they
trying
won't
to make sparks go together. Almost, right? Like two rocks.
That's right. And then over time, what you start to figure out is how do you fill in those cracks with gold, mm-hmm. right? How is it that these two things fit together? And I think the interesting thing about the Geek Jog podcast is that I think that a large part of what that comes down to is that both of them are about the art of losing.
Yes, and that's what an excellent segue.
Thank you.
So for those of you who have listened to The Art of Losing, thank you. If you haven't, it's on mixmentalarts.co website. It's essentially an essay about how my own kind of experiences and my own kind of journey has revealed to me something that it's super simple and, mm-hmm. and it seems ubiquitous, like it seems something that it's everywhere and it should be kind of, I don't know, obvious to everybody. And that is that losing is something you're going to do constantly, but there's nothing wrong with that necessarily.
It's in fact good.
It's incredibly good. Yeah. And The Art of Losing, I kind of illustrate this and discuss it to a great extent. But essentially, I use games as the greatest example of that, is that the only way to improve at a game typically mm-hmm. is to lose at it. The first time you right. play or do anything, you're going to suck at it, right? That's, what was it, the first step toward being kind of good at something is sucking at something. That's nothing new.
Or Hemingway says the first draft of anything is shit.
Sure.
Right? So you'll find that people in different fields express the same idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, like, the first draft of writing anything, right, is like your first time playing a video game,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
You might, for example, produce 5,000-word blog posts that a very small fraction of humanity wants to read. But the point is, what do you do with that failure?
You learn from it.
Yeah.
And but the key, though, is to not focus on it failing and not labeling it as such and mm-hmm. and kind of like pushing, because that's really what The Art of Losing is about, is overcoming the fear of failing at something. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything that human beings are afraid of, it's failing.
Right.
And it's the thing, and it's the whatever shame we feel or embarrassment or just letting ourselves down or others down, like that is always going to be the strange force. That's probably, if you talk to most people from our generation, most of their big life decisions were based upon at some point them being afraid of failing at, for, whether it's in school or their boss, or maybe it's something that they told their parents they were going to do. And it's great, obviously, to win and succeed at all those things. But mm-hmm. the truth of the matter is no one succeeds 100% of the time.
No, and crucially, I think that's the biggest myth, right? The biggest myth is to think that human success is based on success. Human success is based on failure. It's based on trial and error. And you can't have error. You can't have progress without error.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have progress without a willingness to try, knowing that the whole point is to fail and to fail forward.
But if you are emotionally caught up
yep.
on failing and yep. what that, how that identifies you as a person, mm-hmm. then you're going to miss all of that. You're that's what happens to a child. And mm-hmm. that's what I touch on in The Art of Losing, is that I talk about teaching chess to kids
mm-hmm.
and how that game is so dense and so difficult and so great all at the same time that when a child first starts to learn it, all they do is fail at it. They fail at learning it, like how the pieces move. They fail at the meta of it. They fail at the mid game and the end game and checkmates. And every fucking part of chess is hard for anybody. And for a child in particular who they want it, give me, if they don't get the prize, they're upset or they're sad. And it's a very, very simple, basic human nature that children exhibit. And games help kind of make that really obvious for everybody.
Yep.
Like when people lose, you can look at a child, they don't like it. So if you can teach them, though, that losing is just a part of the process of getting better at something, Which again seems so obvious, but I think is not, it's something we have to be taught still. I think that.
Well, I think the point is, it's not, I mean, listen, it's not obvious to most of humanity. If it was obvious to most of humanity, the world would work very differently.
You're right. Right?
Like when things weren't working, we wouldn't be like nanny nanny poo poos to some politician because he screwed up. Mm-hmm. Right? We'd be like, okay, well, like, this, how do we all do better?
Well, this has to do with something else I wanted to bring up, which is this idea of flip flopping. One thing mm-hmm. that pisses me off when I'm listening to podcasts or I'm seeing online discussions is that there'll be somebody, it doesn't matter if they're a politician or a leader or a celebrity, anybody,
right.
And they'll have a position on something. And they'll probably have a decent cross-section of data for that opinion or that thought process to for their conclusion. Then they get new information.
Right.
Either by a discussion or someone illuminating them to something. And then they change their mind on it. Right. And that somehow, for some reason, oops, is looked down upon. That is something that is like, oh, you're a flip-flopper. Who hasn't right. heard that phrase from like a Rush Limbaugh or you know, an O'Reilly or somebody who is using it as a derogatory term?
But these are, I mean, that's the point. And this is where we can start to weave in your cultural confession.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this comes down to, I mean, you know, you said Rush Limbaugh, right? Mm-hmm. So this comes down to, you know, essentially redneck, right? You know, intuitions about decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people are supposed to be decisive and you're supposed to stick by your word and word is bond and, mm-hmm. you know, that's all you have. And if you start changing your mind on things, that means you're unreliable, you're untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. And there's a cultural assumption that if you are changing your mind on that, that it's because we had a deal.
Yeah.
And then you backed out on that deal, motherfucker. And now shit's going to get real.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell the whole group that this motherfucker over here is a fucking flip-flopper.
Oh,
you'll make
it. I don't want to be that.
Bad, exactly.
I don't want to be a flip-flopper. That sounds bad.
But so the point is that those are like very old cultural intuitions.
Well, I mean, that's like fundamentalism, right? It's like there was an idea that was right and you can't change it now.
Well, and it made sense in, you know, I mean, in an honor culture.
Sorry for
Well, no, but I mean, in an honor culture, it makes sense. Like, your reputation is everything, and the environment isn't changing. It's not like, you know, okay, you're a sheep herder in the 13th century in Scotland.
Okay.
It's not.
I'm there.
Get immersed.
I got my giant, what are those, candy cane looking thing?
Crook. We'll call it a candy cane. So you got your candy cane. I'm really excited because the green screen. Now Andrew will put that up. So you got your candy cane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that all of a sudden, you know, it's not like it, suddenly there's new things happening in sheep husbandry where now it's like, oh, I had this whole idea about sheep husbandry, but then there's this really interesting new data emerging around sheep husbandry.
It's better to have not a candy cane, but just a straight staff. Who would have thought?
Right.
There's great new research.
Right. So the environment wasn't dynamic enough that you wanted to be changing your decision
making. Well, no one was exchanging information,
right? That's right. There wasn't much information flow. There was some information flow, but not the kind of rate of information flow that we're seeing now.
So you think because of those conditions, people were less apt to change their mind or quote unquote flip flop because it was either not an option or not attractive or necessary to do so. But now that we live in this current, you know, hemisphere of history where information is constant and we're all being proved wrong or all being proved how much of a fucking idiot we all are all the time, that I think that it's, you can't be stubborn and not
would be dangerous. But most of the, this is not to say that we should all be changing our mind all the time either. A lot of this comes down to most people have never, I think had to, right? By being in a confusing enough cultural environment where they've had to reflect on what is a decision? It's a super basic question, right? But in fact, you know, and again, like, it's always helpful to look at the etymology. Like, what is the origin of these words? Decision comes from to cut off. That's what decidere means, right?
Okay.
So what you're doing is let's say that I've decided that we're going to Chipotle, right? That's the decision.
We're going
to Chipotle.
All right, going to Chipotle.
And the point is, we've cut off all other options.
All other options.
Right? We're not going to Yoshinoya. We're not going to Krispy Kreme. We're not going to Taco Bell.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to any of these other places. Right? We're going to Chipotle. That's a decision. I've cut off all other paths, and then we're on that. Now, the point is that I can then change my mind based on new evidence. Oh, turns out that Chipotle has had this E. coli outbreak. Data has emerged. Now we're not going to Chipotle.
But Hunter,
yeah,
you're a flip-flopper. Right. Why? You right. told me we were going. I got my hopes up.
Yeah,
and we were on the same page.
Are you so much of a pussy you can't handle a little E. coli? Ass beef, Jack in the Crack.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So you're telling me that the first sign of troubled waters, you're just gonna walk the plank?
Yeah. So
but that's ridiculous.
It's of course ridiculous. But the point is that if you're coming from an honor culture and you've never really reflected on your intuitions, right? Then what ends up happening is that you have an emotional reaction about seeing somebody change their mind, somebody in power, and you're like, I can't rely on this person. This person is untrustworthy. And
reliability.
Reliability is what they're really looking for.
Because they said it, and you thought they were going to continue to say and then they didn't say it. So now
they're untrustworthy.
They changed their mind. So
and to be fair, right? I think that the other thing is that you have to look at sort of what are the problems with dignity cultures or weird cultures, right? Mm-hmm. Around decision making, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem is that they try and figure out everything on their own very often. So they're not really working together to form a conclusion. Look at I started calling science, the scientific establishment, weird science.
Yeah.
Because it is. Everything's compartmentalized into their little compartments. So they're not working together and forming any sort of clear conclusion that a person who, who's a scientist in an adjacent field can understand. Like, science is the least organized, weird science is the least organized religion in history.
Do you think it should be more collaborative then?
Of course. That's science is supposed to be.
And in order to be less weird, they need to...
Well, they need to. I mean, firstly, they have to understand that it's not that dignity is better than honor, right? They both have their
places. Scientific dogma? Is that what you're talking
about? No. So these are basic intuitions, right? So like atomism and holism, right?
Okay, sure.
So the point is that is it good to break things up into little pieces to understand them? Yes, right? But sometimes you need to put everything together into a big whole, right? So it's not that one is good or one is bad. It's that there's an alternating between them to see how they're used. The same thing with intuitions about honor and dignity, right? Sometimes you have to be dignified and you have to stand apart from the group, right? And you have to put yourself up and like, I'm not going to sully myself and get down in there.
Right.
But sometimes you have to police your honor and police your reputation. And in fact, if you look at part of the problems with science is so dignified that scientists aren't willing to go out and defend their reputation. And so people are allowed to go out and piss science's reputation away, and they never go and handle it.
Combo. So did you watch, there was a recent Joe Rogan podcast where he had a guy named Randall Carlson another gentleman who I'm not familiar with.
Tucker Carlson was the other.
I think it was...
I know the podcast you mean.
But anyways, the point is that it was one of the first times I had seen on as big of a platform as Rogan's podcast is, where he had two very well-versed, raw scientists debating this subject. And at the time it was if there were asteroidal impacts and how that affected the shaping of human civilization. It was a very interesting topic. It was very heady. I think most of what those two guys talked about was not interpretable to me. So the point though is that it was a platform for them to do it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I would like to see either with mixed mental arts or with anybody who's making dojos out there. Just creating a platform where you can have two scientists who are trying not to inflict scientific dogma or are trying to. They're trying to basically listen to each other and maybe admit that they don't have all the information.
Yeah. And do that in a public forum.
Yes, so because, that other people can look at it.
And hear it, and then the community can decide. And that's the point of the intellectual thunderdome, right? And, in essence, humanity is in an intellectual thunderdome, right?
Yeah.
So all these ideas are already fighting. Right? There are fights going on over vaccination. There are fights going on over whether the earth is flat or round. There are fights going on over evolution, right? And there's the fight over, creationism versus evolution. And then there's the fight within science about
millions of fights.
Group selection versus gene-centric evolution, right? So there's all these fights going on, right? But the problem is that most of them are not in a form that most of us can track. It's messy. Yeah, and think about if you took mixed martial arts and ran mixed martial arts the way that science is run, right? So you
I don't even know how that would
look.
Well,
think about it, right? Okay, so you know who? Well, you would probably know this better because you know the world.
Yeah, yeah,
MMA better than. But so Conor McGregor had that great line: "Who the fuck is this guy?"
Yeah, like, who the fuck is that? It was what's his face? The guy who doesn't know. It was another 145 pounder.
Yeah.
Who Jeremy Stephens, right? Great fighter, but basically he called him out. And
okay, so Stephens and Connor, Jeremy Stephens. Okay, mm-hmm. So Jeremy Stephens and Connor McGregor, right? Mm-hmm. So, but now we make Jeremy Stephens Richard Dawkins, and we make Connor McGregor David Sloan Wilson, and they have an intellectual dispute, right? But what happens is instead of Jeremy Stephens and Conor McGregor stepping into the ring together, ultimately to settle things in front of the public and to duke it all out and maybe over many rounds, and that, you know, we're really sort of sorting through all of this and coming to track the conflict. Instead, what happens is that Jeremy Stephens and Conor McGregor never see each other, right? You know, or they have very limited interaction. They write long, instead of like clear trash talk, like who the fuck is this guy, right? They write, you know, these very long, circuitous things where there may be a conflict there, but it's not at a level that most people can even track or make sense of, right? And they do this for years and years and years until eventually they both die off. And then essentially the next generation decides what was the best thing.
Yeah,
and they
have to like sift through it.
Wouldn't
it be great if you could get those two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Harrison, who's the other gentleman?
Richard Dawkins and David Sloan Wilson.
So you get to, wouldn't it be great if we could get two guys or guys like them or women like them, whoever, and put them down, and the first things that they said to each other, like if this could happen, it would be like mind blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And first thing they say to each other is like, all right, I'm not going to try to win this, and I might be wrong about some of these things, and I want to get better at understanding the subject that we're talking about. If both could do that, wouldn't it be a magical thing? Wouldn't it be spectacular?
You just described what science is supposed to be.
But that doesn't happen.
But that's not the way that it's working now.
And this has to do with like self-preservation and the fact that you have to make a name for yourself and you have to kind of stick to your own guns and not flip-flop and all that other shit. Is that why you think?
It's based on, this is the fucked up thing, okay? Yeah. And you couldn't be a better person to talk about this with, okay?
Yeah.
Science is about the art of losing. That's literally what it's about.
Should be.
That's you know what science is about.
Yeah,
right.
Proving
is disproving. Right. Your beliefs. And as Spiros said, you know, always love talking to Spiros.
Mm-hmm.
But as Spiros said, the point is that you want that belief to die, because once that belief dies, then it makes sense for a better belief. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That you're constantly, you know, killing things off. It's about killing your bad ideas, so that whatever survives and thrives is something that is really robust and tough.
But I think what's difficult, though, is that there is a strange, weird, like, refractory period between the destruction of an idea, of a personal idea, and what fills its place. And I think that is what people are afraid of.
The vacuum.
Is like once you create, like, it's like getting out of a relationship. It's like you have this emotional connection to another person, and in this analogy, an idea maybe, and then you excavate that idea or get it out for in hopefully place of a better one, and you break up with somebody in hopes of getting in a better relationship later, right? But that interim, that time between the breakup and the next love interest is super fucking painful. No one wants to go through that. And that's where that fear of losing and that art of losing really have to come into place. And so bringing it back to the scientific community, do you think then it's just all these assholes just have to get over the fact that they have to be like the kids I teach in chess and be like, just get over it, man, and lose a little bit, and you will learn so much more than what you've done just trying to win all the time.
Well, I mean, I think the point is that, you know, the basic problem, if you're a scientist and you're going through that whole bureaucratic system, is that you aren't celebrated for losing.
Right. You're only celebrated for
winning. Mm-hmm. And then what ends up happening is that you build a reputation based around an idea rather than building a reputation around being someone who's willing to be wrong faster. Mm-hmm. And you're not celebrated for how quickly do you lose and how quickly you're not celebrated for your behavior, right? You're celebrated for, it's essentially, you know, imagine like, since so much of the art of losing, right, mm-hmm. is about, you know, like let's take Mega Man 2.
Sure.
Right? Let's imagine that you had a really good run on Mega Man 2.
Sure. Didn't die.
Didn't die.
Did really well.
And you got to like level 3, yeah. Right?
And killed 3 of the mini
big
bosses.
Yeah. And so, you know, the point is that you do that in your 20s and 30s, right? And then, you know, people are like, holy shit. Like, you know, the guy had not been playing for very long. And then all of a sudden he had this amazing run. And then it becomes like, okay, you know, now everybody's watching that game tape of what I did in that play. And then we start saying why it was so great. We're defending it. We're protecting that little thing. Mm-hmm. But you're avoiding essentially, you know, doing anything different, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what you're hanging your hat and your reputation on.
You could be getting to the 4th, 5th, or 6th
exactly.
guy.
Exactly.
But because there's a reputation of you having done the first 3 so well,
yep.
that there's, I guess, there's no reason to get better at it.
And crucially, in order to get to the 4th, 5th, or whatever, you very often have to destroy what you already had, mm-hmm. right? So that's this process of creative destruction, right? So creative destruction just means, you know, you can, it's easy to see in technology, mm-hmm. right? So in technology, you know, for example, for years and years and years, to go back to Candy Cane Land, right? You know,
yeah.
there were weavers, right? And weavers worked with these sort of very simple looms and physical looms and you know, manually powered tools, mm-hmm. right? And then what happens is that these in the Industrial Revolution starts happening, and there's a series of technologies that come along that make it better and better to be able to do these things, right? So you mm-hmm. have the spinning jenny, and you have the steam-powered loom, and you have all of these innovations. And suddenly, you know, one person can do the work of 50 people. Mm-hmm. So what that does is it means creativity, right? You're able to produce a lot more output, but it also means destruction. Because now those other 49 people aren't needed to do their jobs.
And this can go back to the jobocalypse.
It's exactly.
Jobocalypse.
But creative destruction is the force that underlies that. Mm-hmm. And creative destruction has always been happening, right?
Yeah.
And it's always, people think that innovation is good, right? That it's just sort of this universal good and we all love it. But it creates this problem of destroying the old culture and the old way of doing things. Mm. And so that's why in Why Nations Fail, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson tell this great story about, I think I'm going to say, the Emperor Vespasian. Okay, so it's one of the Roman emperors. And there's a famous story, I think it's from Pliny, where a man comes to the emperor and he says, Oh, Emperor, I have invented, imagine just Brian Callen is the Emperor Callen, right?
Okay.
So the Emperor Callen is there. And this man comes to him and he says, guess what, Emperor Callen? I have invented this method of making unbreakable glass.
Ooh.
Right? It's pretty exciting. Glass breaks all the time. Now you have unbreakable glass.
Great.
And the emperor says, have you told anyone else about this? And he goes, no, I came to you first. And he goes, great. Have this man killed. Because the point is that if you made unbreakable glass, what would happen to the jobs of all the glass makers?
They wouldn't exist.
That's right. And that's the problem of creative destruction, is that when you invent better technologies, you put people out of work.
There's no biological free lunch.
That's right.
Yeah, you ever heard that one?
No.
Well, that's true, is that yeah. it doesn't matter. Listened to a podcast recently about women taking birth control
mm-hmm.
and how people, this is a big misconception about any kind of medicine, mm-hmm. is that you take a medicine, you have a headache, right? Or if you don't want to be pregnant, well, it doesn't just go straight to your uterus or if you have a headache, it doesn't just go straight to your head. It goes through your whole body.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of stuff that happens in that process. So the point is, though, is that, yes, you're going to get a benefit, but mm-hmm. there's going to be side effects.
There are always trade-offs.
Yeah. So
And it's not – and so the key thing is it's not that you don't want that to happen, right? That you don't want that creative destruction to happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and this sort of goes back to the Silicon Valley thing, right? Their goal, it's a culture that is focused on disruption. That's what they want, right? And they're like, let's put out better technologies, better technologies, better technologies. But as with anything, there's an externality. There's a side effect to that. And the side effect is that all these people who were doing these jobs suddenly find themselves out of jobs.
And what do we do about that?
Well, that's the point, is that you need to be able to retrain these people. Because crucially, you know, the education that we were given was designed for a different age.
Right.
It was designed for the industrial age. Mm-hmm. It was not designed for a world of constant disruption where you have to constantly be learning, unlearning, and relearning. Mm. And so that's the point of the mixed mental arts belt system, is to essentially give you the education that you should have gotten to prepare for this moment, which is this, it is, and you know, we're gonna sort of walk you through all that core knowledge and give you ways to essentially get comfortable with how you should be acting in this environment.
So let me ask you something. This is good, because this is a fascinating subject. Is that so we were taught to conduct ourselves and to thrive in a very specific environment that is no longer the reality that we live in.
Yep.
And this is true for all of our previous generations as well that are still alive. So does that mean, it means a couple things. One is that our technology is outpacing our culture and is outpacing our ability to manage it. Mm-hmm. And the other is what is the effective, way to cope with that? Is that technology is going to keep going. That's a momentum that is irreversible, and it's impossible to stop or to slow down. It's going to keep going. And that means that there's going to be more automation, and there's going to be more of these instances of creative destruction and this disruption that's going on. So do we temper the innovation in order to not?
Nope.
So how do we take what is old, a bunch of 40, 50, 60-year-olds and who haven't done any kind of training or have any kind of adaptation skills, and do they just subscribe to mixed mental arts? I mean, that obviously would be one tool to help them, but I think that the answer is a much larger one than that.
Well, the point is that I don't think that, I don't know that there's anyone that I've seen out there who's explicitly gone past trying to talk about this problem and trying to actually solve it.
Yeah, because it's so immense. It seems immense.
And that's the point, is that you've got 7.5 billion humans that you have to onboard into this new world, into this new reality. And the point is that it's, Matt Maurer, one of the other Matts, who built the very first version of the website. But he said there's this great thing. We have to essentially approach cultural software in the same way that Silicon Valley approaches computer software. It's the exact same thing.
So creative destruction of
cultural software.
Cultural software as well. I mean, could, not to take it to an extreme, but would that be why we're having wars, ongoing physical conflicts and all of that? Is that because it's a literal unfolding of that process? Is that we are creatively destroying, like literally creating and literally destroying culture?
Yeah, so I think our development has been very uneven, right? So it's no different than, a human body, right? Sometimes you have people who there's all these great, great photos of people who skip leg day, right? And, they're like massive, huge torso, and then they have these skinny little chicken legs, right? And that's humanity right now, right?
Definitely.
So there's this massive torso of technology, computers, software, all of that. But the problem is the legs are super weak and can't really support that.
So like the utopian idea behind mixed mental arts would be that we can exchange in equal parts all of these great ideas and give people the tools and the platform necessary to exercise those ideas, and not necessarily to guide them toward any cemented ideology, but rather to have that tool belt of ways of interpreting and adapting and getting better at all this shit. And I guess that's what, at least one of my motivations, that art of losing, man, is like just being like, it seems to pervade everything that we're discussing right now, is that there's always a, what was that?
Well, but I was going to say, see, what you've done with the art of losing is what this all requires. Mm-hmm. You have a thing that you developed over a long time. Mm-hmm. And it was born of this process of trying to take these two pieces of your life and fit them together. How do I put geek and jock together? Mm-hmm. How do I do that? And it took you a long time to figure out how you put them together. And out of that, you emerge with this very simple, clear tool. The Art of Losing.
Mm-hmm.
But you could have, I mean, you know, Christopher, you have to understand Big Papa Werewolf. What you could have done is you could have said, this is mine. It's my idea. I worked on it. And now I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to build my own website. And I'm going to write my own book. And I'm going to make myself a guru around the art of losing.
And I'm the one who came up with it.
I invented it and all of that. But instead, you did something else. You said, here it is, humanity. It's yours. It's free. And I took this thing that I cherished and that I worked on for a long time that comes out of my personal pain. And I'm sure there was a lot of pain there.
Yeah, definitely.
And you simplified it down and put it in a really tight, simple form and made it accessible to the community. Mm-hmm. And in practice, you know, it's available to the mixed mental arts community. But guess what? People could come in here who fucking hate all of us and take that idea, and they could adapt what is useful, discard what is not, and add what is uniquely their own. And they're like, I like that idea and I'm going
to
take it.
And I think that would be great though. Yeah. That's the idea. That's the point. Is that I don't know, like, to have ownership. I think all these things come back to ego, yeah. I think, Hunter, because whether it is you're afraid of losing or you want to preserve your original thoughts and you don't want to flip-flop, or you don't want people to take your idea or something, like, all of that shit just comes down to the weird monkey part of our brains.
Man.
Yeah, being a, like, a golem.
Yeah.
Being a,
or the version that I love is, do you remember that, have you ever seen that Looney Tunes Daffy Duck cartoon?
Probably.
Yeah, there's a great one with Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny, and it's all over some sort of diamond or whatever.
Okay.
And that they're trying to get, and, you know, Bugs and Daffy fight over it, and at a certain point, Daffy's like, mine. And, you know, that's what it comes down to, is that a large part of, you know, the old intuitions is trying to keep our ideas for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, what is mixed mental arts, right? It's not that there's like a set tool belt. It's an evolving tool belt that's going to get tighter and better and all of that.
Mm.
And it becomes, you know, the point is the great thing about the art of losing, great thing about that t-shirt, the great thing about video games is that, you know, this is much of what Katie O and I were writing about in the Straight A Conspiracy. But I think this is a more powerful metaphor than one that we used in the Straight A Conspiracy.
It is.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because I think that games do it in the most direct way possible. Here's a game. Here's what a game is. A game is something people do that has rules.
Right.
Where when you win, you get something that's positive somehow.
Right.
And whether that's encouragement or praise or money or any of that stuff, there's something that you're trying to achieve. And I think that games do this excellent job because it makes it to where it's easier to do than most other things in life. Like most things like 500 years ago that were not games, because there were games then obviously too, where if you failed, well, you may die.
Right.
And you may have, or you may not procreate, or you may lose a family member, or something really, really legitimately bad would happen. But with a game, you're kind of given this wonderful little environment to where you can make those mistakes, you can get fucked up. And that's why I like chess so much. Like, one of my favorite things that chess ever taught me was, because I feel like if you get good at a game like chess, you get good at all games.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just, again, just like the art of losing, one thing that reappears over and over and over again in many different contexts is, if somebody knows in chess, if you and me are playing each other in chess, and you know one more thing than I do, one thing, one move, one through line, one way to checkmate me, and I don't know that thing, you will continually exploit that until I either learn how to deal with it or stop playing. There's the only two ways to go about it.
Yeah.
So, and that's what's great is that I can be playing somebody in that game and they can teach me something every single time they do something I haven't seen before.
Mm.
And it's up to me to continually want to, I guess this is where the real challenge comes from, is the motivation behind it, wanting to adapt and wanting to improve. I could just go, well, I'm not going to play this guy anymore. He does this one fucking thing that I'm uncomfortable with and I'm not able to get past. Well, that just seems silly. That just seems like not the growth mindset.
That's right. And that's the point, is you use the word adapt. And what does it take to succeed and thrive in this environment? Evolution, right? Evolution is not just a theory, it's a way of living.
Mm.
And if you are constantly, you know, do I have I have many areas in which I need to continue to involve, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have helped me with some of those.
Yeah,
sure. In terms of teaching me how to do sound.
And I'm sure many people online have told you all of the things that you need to get better
at. Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's the great thing. No, but I mean, my verbal tics, right?
The wisdom of crowds.
The wisdom of crowds. And they're going to tell you things, mm-hmm. and you can use humanity as your team of rivals, where they send you, they're giving you, they're trying to help me out.
Well, that's the thing that's so crazy about all this, is that we are in the prime time of when anybody can lose. You can lose more now, in more ways possible now. Yeah. You can lose in ways that you, people will invent ways for you to lose.
It's amazing.
Now. It's amazing.
And thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Namaste, for sending me ways that I have lost. And then that's the point, is that you'll improve. And you'll use them in some way. And, you know, that's what I've learned, is just that it's actually a huge asset, right? Hang a lantern on your failures, because part of what they do is they humanize you, mm-hmm. and then it makes you approachable. And then, you know, you ultimately, I think that's the point, is just that, you know, if we create a community where everybody is just throwing in all their best ideas and offering them up, mm-hmm. and then we're taking them and we're evolving them, and then we're saying, listen, Hunter, I know you kind of got a lot of this party started, and you wrote a book called The Straight A Conspiracy, and it's great. There's a lot of value there, but I kind of like Christopher Leon Price's way of thinking about failure better.
Yeah.
And then the point is, I'm like, I agree. I think that that's a better way to think about it, is video games. Because video games, the whole point is, you know that you're supposed to die, mm-hmm. and then do it again. And improve the process by which you play that video game. And what you're really refining is the process, mm-hmm, right? When do you jump? When do you duck? When mm-hmm. do you this? When do you that, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And what's the whole point is that, you know, we need to, if all of human, if that's one of those, it's not if. That's one of those ideas that we need to democratize, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I've been saying this for years on this podcast to the emperor, about just like, you know, that's a thing that any human should be doing.
Yeah. But it's hard to have that kind of self-improvement, though. I think most people are just trying to get through the day. They're trying to pay their bills.
These are great.
And it's kind of like, I don't know. I sometimes feel like when we wax poetics like this, we're similar to the students at the step of Plato who...
Well, let me throw something your way.
Yeah, yeah.
It's harder to not learn from your mistakes, because that means you're repeating them again and again and again.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, if you've got somebody who's playing, you know, Mega Man 2 or whatever, right? You in The Art of Losing, you highlighted a few parts in Mega Man 2 that are particularly tough.
Particularly difficult parts.
So what are examples?
So like, for instance, what the image screenshot is in the article is from Heat Man's stage. And Heat Man has this notorious, it's like historically notorious stage where they have these blocks that have this incredibly distinct sound effect when they appear and disappear, which is like a boop. Boo!
Oh, I actually remember this.
And so if they're there, you can jump on them. If they're not. And basically getting through it, especially in the age in which it came out when there was no internet or play guides on how to get through it, it was basically just jump through the damn thing until you figure out where the blocks are going to be and where they're not going to be.
Right.
And so that whole process was just jumping to your doom, hoping that you guessed right this time until you learned it.
Right.
And so that's where failure was intricately woven into the gameplay itself. It wasn't an option.
Right.
To no one gets through it the first time.
Well, and also crucially, you know, there was something that I remember as well about Mega Man 2, that it was structured in such a way where you then had to go all the way back, right? There were no...
Yeah, so like this is an old school gaming thing as well, that like some, like this is an interesting segue or like tangent, would be that so back in the day, you either had no passwords,
right,
or passwords, and if you lost, you had to you go back. You go back to the beginning of the level.
Right.
You go back to the beginning of the game, maybe, depending. Nowadays, we have autosave, where every 15 seconds, you take a few steps, and the game will save it for you, and you can just save that or load that state.
Right.
And there was no actual punishment. There is no actual punishment for losing. You just go back to where it was, which is, it's debatable whether or not that's a better or worse gameplay mechanic. I am a masochist in some way when it comes to gaming, and I prefer the sting of oh, you didn't save. Oh, you weren't perfect, dude. Well, guess what? You got to go back.
Right.
And that, because that would motivate me more to want to accomplish it. And it made the overcoming of those obstacles that much more exciting.
Satisfying.
Right. And that's another big thing, too, that I hope people, like, when I wrote The Art of Losing, it's not like losing. Like, losing is great in a lot of ways. And winning is great, too, though. Like, winning makes you feel good.
Right.
And I think, though, that they're dirty words. Mm-hmm. To lose is a dirty word, and to win is a dirty word in a lot of ways. But a lot of times, they're one and the same.
Right.
And one makes the other magnified.
Right.
If you win a lot and then you lose, that's going to make it feel much worse.
Right.
And if you lose a lot and then you win all of a sudden, like if you play someone in a game and they constantly beat you and then you eventually beat them, then that's going to make the victory that much better. So the idea is, like, just, I don't know, stop, don't be a pussy about it. Just accept the loss and then move on from it. And then get better and enjoy it and use it.
Yeah. And so I think that's the point in terms of people being busy, people being short on time, all of that stuff. If you're short on time and you have low bandwidth and all of that, right? The point is that it's to keep on, there are many things that for years and years and years I failed at, and then I rationalized away that failure and said it wasn't my fault, it wasn't my responsibility.
That's what happens a lot.
A lot of what humans do.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, you get better and better at, instead of just being like, fucking heat, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that level's too hard. That's it. Yeah, yeah.
You're just like, man, I better figure this thing out by some method, because otherwise I'm just going to keep dying at heat, man. And that's the real point, is that it's about identifying what are your heat mans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have heat mans. These are some of my heat mans. They're the Great Tetons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think one of the two articles I would like to write next, because I would like to write follow-ups to The Art of Losing, like parts two and part three, would be how to lose, not the art of losing necessarily, but like when you lose, what now?
Yeah.
I just lost.
Right.
What do I do? And then there's actually some steps that one can take in order to get the most out of losing.
Right.
And then the third thing would be, what was the third thing? Oh, I had this. What were you talking about? Your heat mans. Oh, identifying it would be finding out how to, I guess, apply those lessons. It's like you lost, you got lessons out of them. Okay, well now, how do you actually start implementing that?
That's right.
And I think that that's a subject worth exploring as well, and kind of finding out, and maybe you can, or maybe I can use other games or other things in order
to
figure that out.
I think the crucial thing is that, oh God, there's that word again.
Crucial
is one of my new verbal tics.
Oh no.
Yeah. Unikitty hates that one. But one of the important things, it's that a lot of people spend their time being like, I fucking lost, as opposed to then figuring out, okay, great, I lost. How do I now have to change what I do the next time, right? And evolving the way that you're approaching it. Mm-hmm. And I think that the interesting thing is you're talking about modern games where it like auto-saves and essentially coddles you.
It
does. And then there's Mega Man 2 where it challenges you.
Mm-hmm.
But the ultimate game, the most challenging game of them all, is the game of life.
Of course.
Because you get one character, you get one man, essentially, one life. That's the vocabulary.
No save points.
No save points. And the whole world is watching, right? So there's like maximum social pressure.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what mixed mental arts is about. It's about it's a community for people who are life gamers.
Yeah.
And that we are really trying to figure out, how do these rules work? What are the rules around? And we figured out different parts of the game.
This is what I was going to say before. I'm sorry. Shit, by the way, Hunter.
Thanks.
But I was going to say that third article,
mm-hmm.
Breaking the Game,
mm.
That's another thing. One of my favorite people of all time, and she'll be happy that I'm plugging her, is Daphne Green. If you're out there, Daphne, love you so much. One of my favorite
Daphne.
People. Yeah, one of my favorite human beings. Old roommate of mine, and her and I used to play Mega Man and a bunch of other hardcore old school games are very, very difficult. And one of our favorite things to do was be like, okay, these fucking games are so hard, and maybe they're poorly designed, and, or maybe they're just not that great even, but there's a way to break it. There's a way to break those systems and to exploit them. Chess is no different. Chess is the most, one of the most balanced games ever made. There's a way to break it in some way. And one of the fun things about losing is that you get more data for breaking the game. And everybody has the games. Everybody has their Heat Man kind of level, right? And we have tons of those. Well, if you once you break the game and you get past the Heat Man level, well, it's no longer a problem. And it's something that it's you'll learn to break other games too,
right?
And I think that when I say break a game, what I'm really meaning is just knowing how to cultivate your skill set and knowing how to cultivate your ability to succeed at something despite constant failure and with it. And that's something that's it seems like counterintuitive, but it's the only way to do it, which is to lose and to adapt.
Yeah, but I think also crucially that as Einstein said, right, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing and expecting different results.
Right.
So I think that very often what happens to us humans, or as they say in Battlefield Earth, have you ever seen Battlefield Earth?
I heard it was atrocious.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing because it's so atrocious.
Is that like bad good?
It's bad good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Travolta's in it, right?
It's all the Scientologists. So it's written by L. Ron Hubbard.
Because he made a book.
Yeah. He wrote a lot of books. L. Ron was prolific.
He was the most prolific novelist, I think, of all time, right?
Maybe. I mean, what he lacked in quality, he made up for in quantity.
Yeah.
But clearly. So L. Ron wrote it, and then it's John Travolta, Forrest Whitaker, and I can't remember who else, but it's like a Scientology fest where it's like, these are the only people.
Xenu?
Lord Xenu actually directed it because he's directing the whole galaxy. it's one of the best lines in it is there's some sort of invading alien overlords, and they refer to humans as man animals.
Gosh, man, what an unsophisticated script. Yeah, I'm just saying, I guess it's like, who writes this? One could not even write these things, but they obviously did. So.
And then they get funded. But power of religion. So man animals, right? One of the basic problems of being man animals is that I use the Steve Jobs quote all the time, is that you are taught rules by your culture. And very often you can get stuck thinking that those rules are actually the rules of the world, but they're actually just the rules of convention, right? And Steve Jobs has this great thing in Steve Jobs' Lost Interview where he says, business seems hard to learn, right? But then at a certain point, you start to realize that most of what businesses do come down to folklore. Right. So it's the way that things have always been done. Nobody ever has ever really questioned them. And then, if you just
for business. Huh. I feel like I would like you to explain that a little better. I don't quite understand.
So he gives an example of there's some warehousing thing and there's something that's being done in this warehouse and it's not working. And they're like, we have to do, it's essentially like the TPS report in Office Depot. There's a way that we have to do these things. Then you say, why do we do this?
Because that's the way we've always done it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
And sometimes it's that it never made sense, but sometimes it's that it made sense, but there's technology available that means that actually no longer makes sense.
We got to catch up to all that.
Well, and that's the hard part. But I think that's the key job of mixed mental arts is if you have a community that are constantly asking why, and then when you ask why, one of two things happens. Either people can tell you, and they've actually thought this thing through, and then they can explain it, and they can say, here's why we came to this decision, right? Here's why we're doing this thing. Here's why we settled on this answer. And then you can review that, and, it's always, there's that. Or alternatively, you find that people are stumped, and they, have no good reason. It's a thing they never particularly thought about and a thing they never particularly questioned.
And I think that, there's a lot of that, because how can you think about everything? It's hard to come to a conclusion on any of this. And this is something, because we're about at our hour, by the way. Let's check. I want to end on this. This is something. So we tell people on this show and in many different ways that we want to give them these tools. We want to give them this bedrock from which they can kind of a foundation that they can build upon. And one of the things I think is difficult, at least that me being the kind of, I don't know, flip-flopper I am, of not knowing exactly what to put my hat on, you know, is that like sometimes you're learning a lot in your creating that, you're doing that creative destruction with yourself. And it's sometimes when you wake up in the morning, though, you just have to have something that is a stable thought process just to get through the fucking day. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's your religion, your belief in a higher power, or maybe it's just like, oh, I can only rely on myself and, you know, fuck society because it's not looking out for me. There's a million different ways that you could do that. I think, though, when you're going through this process, it's slippery, because if you're always willing to admit that you might be wrong and you're always losing and trying to find out why you lost and you're kind of doing all these things that we tell people to do, it's like you do have to come to conclusions eventually.
Oh, and that's the point. The point is to come to conclusions.
And that's what's difficult, though, is that like not only come to conclusions, but also be willing to maybe exchange those conclusions later, given new information.
That's right. But the point is that it's like the Chipotle thing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You make a decision, we're going to Chipotle, new evidence emerges, and that, you know, they're serving ass meat, and then this is, by the way, is that like
serving ass
is that
meat?
Is that also like is that now libel? Am I now,
hey,
you want to
go eat some ass, Hunter? Yeah. Let's go eat some ass, yeah, at Chipotle, buddy.
Or whatever it was that happened there, right?
Yeah.
And the point is that then you unmake the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So you can always make and unmake decisions. That's always an option for
It's only an illusion that you can't.
Of course. And so, but the point is that so decisions are not permanent, mm-hmm. right? Like
very yeah. very impermanent.
Yeah. But the point is that, you know, I think also crucially, like somebody was on the Mixed Mental Arts forum the other day and they were like, you know, you're very dismissive of anarcho-capitalism. Why are you so dismissive of it? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that I'm dismissive of it because I've dismissed it. Because I went through a whole bunch of reading and made a whole bunch of decisions and decided that that wasn't a viable thing. Now, the point is that, you know, all they're seeing at this stage is that I have decided that it's not worth consideration, that I'm dismissive of it, right? Mm-hmm. They're not seeing those 13 years of that process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is, if they want to go, you know, I directed them, I said, go read this, go read this, go read this, if you're interested,
mm-hmm.
right? But it maybe at some point some evidence surfaces that says, oh man, anarcho-capitalism is the thing. That's the wave of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that's going to happen realistically.
Yeah.
But the point is that I can always unmake that decision. But part of moving forward, right,
mm-hmm.
is that I, you know, if I'm constantly considering every option, then there's no focus to my life.
Yeah.
And there, you know, there are things that I could be doing. Like, you know, at various times in my life, like all my dad's family were doctors. So I have huge respect for medicine. You know, going to medical school is a thing that like has a certain emotional appeal to me. But I made a decision a while ago that wasn't the thing I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Could I unmake that decision at some
point?
Maybe. But, you know, I don't know that I'm going to unmake that decision.
Well, I mean, I think this comes down to, you ever read Stephen Pressfield's
The War of Art? Yeah.
Excellent book.
Yep.
One of my favorite things he says in that is that an artist is similar to a samurai, is that every morning the samurai must hold onto his sword and be ready to use it, because that is the way of the samurai, is to be ready for combat every
right.
single day. And I think that one of the things that I would like everybody to know as much as possible is that your mindset and your opinions and your thoughts are not in stone.
No.
They will change. You may come to certain conclusions, right, given new information, but almost inevitably, those conclusions will themselves be replaced with new conclusions. And it's a constant, never-ending, or at least in practice, should be a never-ending cycle of new ideas becoming old ideas, being replaced by new ideas. And that's the thing, is that no one should ever come onto you this podcast, and if they do, then I want you to smack them in the face, where they say, I got it. I these are the rules. These are the commandments. And if we follow it this way, if we think this way, well, then we will never have a problem. Well, that's bullshit. Anybody who tries to say that any kind of way about going in that direction, is the way to go, is trying to make money off of you or trying to control your mind in some way.
I think you have to distinguish between that and, because you talked about as well about getting up in the morning and having something that you could hold on to.
Yes, yes.
And there are principles, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's the point, is there are certain principles that are pretty damn time tested at this point, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
And, you know, already what we're starting to do is we're starting to get certain things that we're pretty comfortable with, or at least mm-hmm. I'm comfortable with, like the Dunbar number. Mm-hmm. Right? Like,
you only know so many people.
You can only know so many people, right? And most people are sort of a character in your mind, mm-hmm. and you don't know the real person.
Right.
And even, you know, you're married to your spouse for 40 years.
You have a narrative about them, too.
Right. Yeah. So those sorts of ways of thinking, or growth mindset, right? Growth mindset around your intelligence, right?
But my point is, is that those are methods, but they don't bring you to distinct conclusions. It's only a conclusion that you yourself can make. Your conclusion will be different than mine, but we can still use that same tool. And I think that that's kind of the whole point, is that these things that we're talking about are great. However, it's only how you use them. You know, a hammer you can use to hit a nail, or you can use a bludgeon somebody with.
Yep.
And I think that the same thing can be applied to all these ideas, is that you can
use them. But at a certain point, and this is, you know, like, this is, I mean, you know, where does this thing evolve to and where does this thing emerge to, right? Mm-hmm. So let's imagine that, you know, we've got this belt system up. We're shuttling people through it, right? They're telling us what works and doesn't work about it, and we're improving it, and the belt system's getting better and better and better and better able to, you know, the website's getting better able to handle all that capacity, and more humans have sort of climbed up that pyramid of hobbits and are exposed to these ideas, and mm-hmm. like, increasingly, we're all sort of embracing the art of losing.
Sure, let's say we get zeitgeist on this motherfucker.
That's right.
Everything gets into the hive mind.
That's right. And the hive mind is running this shit, and we're all sort of embracing the art of losing and all of these sorts
all
of principles.
All the other excellent things, right.
And we're tearing through those 60 million scientific papers and the 130 million books and all of that.
Sure.
And we're figuring these things out, and we're making decisions, right?
Sure. That sounds awesome.
It sounds awesome, and that's really the goal. And at a certain point, you know, we will start having, like, there will start to be conclusions that are reached.
I think that maybe it's cultivating an intellectual revolution, really.
That is what we are doing.
And making it to where it's not any specific ideology or specific, like I said, these conclusions, I keep using that word, but it's so true, is that there's certain conclusions every individual is going to come up with. And really all they have to do, though, is have the right methods and how to get to those things.
That's right.
And if we have as many people at least operating in that way, we'll at least be able to avoid a lot of the same problems that we've been creating and unable to avoid in the past.
But that's the key thing, is that what, you know, this, I think there's a couple of things, right? There's a few assumptions that are baked into the culture of mixed mental arts, right? Failure is good, right? Because if you use that failure to practically improve, then you get better, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wisdom of crowds, right? Social intelligence. It's not about any individual apart from Brian Callen knowing all the answers. And Brian apparently knows all the answers but refuses to tell them to anybody because he's sometimes a little bit of a dick.
Sure. Everybody's a little bit of a dick sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes, you know? Yeah. But, you know, the idea of sort of log and splinter, right? That we all have our biases and that the
sacred cows.
And that we all see clearer by picking the splinters out of each other's eyes, right? And the logs out of each other's eyes. And, you know, these sorts of assumptions are baked in. And we've now got certain other things, right? The idea of blind copying of culture through awe. That's one of those sort of assumptions that's being baked in. But the picture will become clearer and clearer and clearer. Mm-hmm. And there will be things that will become clearer in other areas. For example, Jenny Aguilar recently threw in this thing about birthing, right?
Okay.
And the fact that, you know, what happens is that, you know, human females, right, are designed like the squatty potty. There's an alignment for birthing, right?
Okay.
And it's squatting. Right? Or being on all fours. But the posture that makes the least sense is lying on your back. Right?
But that's what we make them do.
But that's what we make them do. So if you look at how hunter-gatherers behave, you look at how people behave in the developing world, right? Both around whether they're squatting out a baby or a food baby, right? There's a body posture there. Right? Yeah. And the point is that our culture is weird because we don't do that body posture. And, you know, if you talk to her, you know, she'll talk to you all about the tailbone. There's a tailbone that makes it harder for the baby to come out that way. And sometimes you do have to use cesarean sections, right? But there's, I think she said it was 5 to 15% is sort of what the level should be. But you find certain cultures like Brazil, it's 80%.
Wow.
So they're just sort of like cutting open all the women.
Yeah, it's even changing the like birth canals of the next generation of women because we are doing so many cesarean sections that it's not – the birth canal isn't – the hips don't need to be as wide in order to actually birth. So it is fascinating that we're changing. I guess it then – what you're talking about there is like, how do we find a way to optimize what we were designed, quote unquote, to do, or we've evolved is probably a better way to say it. We were evolved to do, such as squatting in that way. And then there's like intellectual squatting as well, is that there are certain things that that we, like the Dunbar number,
right?
That would be an example of an intellectual squatting, is that is something that works best if we get that understanding. So maybe if we just have to disseminate as much of that kind of those kinds of tidbits as well, hopefully, you know, make the world a better place.
But these are, I mean, these are the sort of the tools that we need to sort of start to have that better culture emerge,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if every human being, right, you know, sort of knew about the idea that culture binds and blinds, and that you have a culture and that it is binding you into a group and blinding you,
mm-hmm.
the world would be better. If everybody knew about the Dunbar number and understood mm-hmm. that, then they would be interacting with each other differently on social media. How do we know? Look at the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group. It's mm-hmm. a very different form of interaction, mm-hmm. right? Because people are a little bit more aware that, like,
there might be there's scrutiny going on.
That's right. There's scrutiny going on, but scrutiny of others, where you're trying mm-hmm. to figure out what other people's deal is,
mm-hmm.
and you're also scrutiny of yourself. You're like, mm-hmm. what's going on with me? What's going on here? And all that. You know, growth mindset, the mm-hmm. art of losing. Like, these are all sorts of things that any human being, if having these tools, these mental tools, mm-hmm. is going to make smarter decisions. They will literally be more intelligent, right?
Yeah.
And that's the point, is that if we democratize those sorts of core tools, then people will make better decisions. But there will be decisions that are made about, like, okay, how do we sort of, you know, go from the current system, right, which is based around the nation state, which is a few hundred years old,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, what a planetary society looks like.
I think that we will hope, I mean, like, the hope is that we figure it out. The hope is that
we will.
Or not.
Or we fail.
And we all die.
We will. I think that's...
But we don't want that to happen, of course.
But I think in terms of the art of losing, we will figure it out.
Yeah, and I think...
And the question is, how many times do we have to die on the heat man level before
we figure it out. And I think that given the current, like we said before, that like there's more opportunities to fail now than ever. And I think that the world, United States in particular, is failing in a lot of ways right now specifically. Yep. And I think that there's an illumination of our failures than more than ever, and an identity of those failures, and a real ownership that I think, an opportunity of ownership to take those failures and to take those instances of losing and to not ignore them, not say that they were mistakes, or not own them. We need to own them.
Right.
And hopefully you do it, and hopefully I do it, and hopefully everybody who's listening or watching or whatever they're doing right now can do it too.
But I think that's the key thing, the crucial thing, lo más importante, is that if you have a community of people who start doing that, right, then what ends up happening is, and people are seeing that they're doing better,
mm-hmm.
then people will copy that success. And then they'll start doing it too.
Well, I mean, that's where the proof exists. Because we can be saying all these things, and then let's say a bunch of people start doing them, and then all those people start failing or doing even worse, like not failing and learning from it, but just doing shitty and like maybe being miserable. Well, then that shows that maybe our ideas aren't the best. But what if it's the opposite happens?
And that is the great thing about evolution.
Yeah,
it is everywhere. And, you know, we are in an evolutionary system.
Whether we want to be or not.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Andrew Hunt is like, thinks that this evolutionary system is a video game or a simulation.
Yeah.
And I think Elon Musk has similar ideas.
And what's scary is that they might be right.
Maybe they are.
And I don't know. And the thing is, though, is that what does it matter? Where does rubber meet the pavement for you as an individual? And that's a rhetorical question. We don't necessarily have to come to any conclusions right now. But I think that's what is interesting, is that you can have the growth mindset. You can believe in the Dunbar number or choose not to. You can think the world is flat. You can think that God created the world in 7 days. You can do a lot of stuff, but really what it comes down to is, how does believing in those things affect your actions and affect you on a daily basis? And I think that that's another podcast, and that's another huge subject, and it's something that is ultimately what all this matters for.
That's right.
Oops. Anyways, so hey, I got to get going.
I got to get going, too.
Yeah? What a coincidence.
What a coinkydink. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, it's a pleasure to introduce to you another member of your community.
It's an honor to do it. Also, I want to address everybody about any kind of audio issues that are going on. We always appreciate the feedback. The feedback is excellent. I don't touch every single episode that comes out, but I touch most of them, and I'm always willing to improve the process. If we get enough input on something, then we will totally take the steps toward making it better. So I want to just address that to the community, that that is something we don't ignore.
Yeah.
That is something I listen to and take personally. So we are always getting better. I am learning from my failures and my losing.
So practicing what he preaches. And then I think the other thing to say as well is that, you know, so much of what this community is built from and is going to be built from is sort of, you know, you have a job, I have a job.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this with our available time.
Right.
And, you know, I think so much of this is in what we're going to start seeing increasingly is that we're all throwing in whatever bits of time and energy we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that's the challenge, is how do we organize all those little pieces of time into something that can grow and can scale to the level where it can take on that zeitgeist.
I can already see it happening. That's that's the exciting thing, is that we've been getting excellent feedback. We've been there's been a lot more traffic on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Things are getting organized on our end. Like, it's really cool to see the MMA community and MMA itself kind of becoming a force, which is cool.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that I'm a part of it, and I like the fact that I'm able to spend time and talk with you, Hunter. I hope it's not the last time that I'm on the podcast.
It's the first of many times.
Wonderful.
First of many times. And it's incredibly cool to now be able to bring this as a video experience and to be in this very cool dojo that Andrew Hunt has built for us.
A variety of locations that are endless.
Where are we now?
I want to be next to a supernova of some kind. Like in mid-supernova, maybe.
Yeah.
Andrew, we can do that.
Yeah. See, my mind went to sex.
Of course it did.
Some,
is that a Dutch thing?
It is a Dutch thing.
Is it?
There is a certain sexual obsession among the Dutch. Everything. No,
you need to get laid, Hunter. I think that's what.
No, that is definitely true. But
who doesn't though?
Who doesn't? No, but there is a certain. I have stories now that I'm thinking about that I'm not going to say on the air, because it involves saying things about people I'm related to.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say any of those things. But it is a very sex positive culture in a way that say Anglo culture is not.
Mm-hmm.
They're very comfortable and very open about their sex.
I would love to discuss that at some point with you.
Maybe off camera or on camera, but you know,
for next time.
At some point. Well, Big Papa Werewolf, thank you so much,
Toto.
Toto.
Always a good time.
And if you guys, you know, want to help out with, for example, the audio.
Sure. You can contact me at clpfilmassist@gmail.com. That's clpfilmassist@gmail.com. Or you can send me a DM or a tweet at clpfilm on Twitter as well. So any of those you can use to contact me. And let's keep it going. Let's make it better.
Domo arigato. Ciao.
All right, so how do we...
Oh, I think we just stopped that sucker. Andrew?
Come in. Oh, sorry, buddy.
Dude, you guys were rocking in here.
Did we?
All right, so that camera's still recording. Podcast is still recording.
One?
Did that one go out?
I think this one may have gone out.
All right, well, I know.
Well, we can use it to go back to his then at some point.
Yeah. Well, it'll be some mix of the... We'll have all the audio.
We'll do what we can.
Yeah, we'll do
what
we can.
You know, when this happens...
And I'm sure we'll post this on the podcast as well.
Oh, yeah, we'll post it on the podcast.
Did you like
audio.
It? Did you have a good time?
Oh, I think that was awesome.
Yeah, I thought it was a great one.
When this happens, you get about at least an hour and 6 minutes.
Okay. So we probably only missed the last bit of it.
Yeah.
And that's no big deal.
Yeah, that's what happened to Hunter.
You get a lot of me at the beginning.
But this sounded like really high energy. Like I could.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was good. This was a real good one.
Okay, great.
I could tell.
Did you hear it?
No, I didn't hear shit, but I heard the intonations. I heard
Andrew, yours was amazing too. But
mine's getting
get
good.
Out of here, Hunter.
Yeah. I am gonna get out of here.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, man.
Hey,
good
to
see you.
As
and
always,
let's you know, we should do another meetup and catch up.
I would
like
to
eat food or something.